Say it one more time. I apologize. I've got director deep. I was practicing this on the ride down, and I was not correct.
Member communications.
Member communications.
And engagement manager.
MCEM. Member communications engagement manager.
That's me.
Well, let's do some engaging then.
Let's do some engaging.
Let's educate. I'm in the mood to be slow and careful. My body's ready for a mountain climb. All of a sudden it will all become lovely. The flower that opens in the morning light.
Today we owe Noah's wife Hester another round
every
of
time.
Applause.
Every anytime.
Time. Every yep. time.
Yes. But truly, much like the Matthew Parks Barbara Bush Children's Hospital episode. Mm-hmm. Along in that email, Hester had kind of reached out and said, "Hey guys, I've met some incredible people. We're doing some incredible partnerships that really have me excited, and I thought they'd be good guests for the podcast." And she sent out a couple recs, and we took that email and reached out to those people. Had an incredible conversation with Matthew Parks. That one really meant a lot to me and was one of the more exciting things I had,
awesome.
Times I had in this chair. Mm-hmm. Not to put a ton of pressure on you, Isabel Smith. But today we sit down with Isabel Smith from the Maine Farm One Trust. And we have, as I understand it, we've been members at Bissell Brothers for a while. We've done different forms of donation and stuff like that, but nothing that was really what you would consider a partnership or really kind of tight and synergistic. But it looks like that might be changing and kind of growing into a more serious partnership. I know Hester was excited. Why don't you kind of tell people listening what they can look for from you guys and us together to kind of set the tone for what Maine Farm One Trust is and what they do and what you do within that ecosystem.
Absolutely. Well, thanks for having me on the pod, guys.
Thank you for coming.
Yeah. So Hester and I have been talking a lot about how we can deepen our connection to Bissell Brothers. So I work for Maine Farm One Trust, and we are a nonprofit that is really concerned with farming here in Maine. And mm-hmm. you guys source a lot of your ingredients from Maine, which we are all about, sourcing from local farmers. And so we are really excited to announce that pretty soon we have a merch partnership coming up with you guys. So there are going to be some cool tote bags and maybe a few other things coming down the line. And then as we unveil that, we'll be talking more about how we can have this creative partnership and think about maybe some events and some other ways that we can get people involved, not only with the great beer, but with farming as well.
Awesome.
Incredible.
Yeah, it's funny on that note, I've been asked, and whether it's on this or whether it's just talking to a coworker about, like, when you kind of get to it, I always come back to the point, like, I don't have really a reason that this relationship formed with Buck Farms, and mm-hmm. we're, you know, getting I have a whole silo of grain that gets filled every time it gets emptied.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think it was such an intuitive thing for a reason I still can't really, like, put my finger on. It was sort of just a recognition of likeness, I guess, and shared values. But I'm very excited to have this conversation because it's definitely something that I, frankly, should be able to articulate better than just being like, it's all in the heart, man. So, that's kind of what I'm looking forward to.
And just to echo on that, I was saying to you on the way in that there's been a couple things that have really changed kind of my worldview in the last few years. And one of them is working for this company and meeting Noah and Hester. And frankly, that thing that Noah's talking about where, like, doesn't scream from the rooftops, like, we buy only Maine grain and we do so much of it and we're doing so much good. Just kind of this innate
that
way.
That would also be a lie, just real quick.
But the way that he is of, like, well, that feels like the right thing to do. I'm just going to go mm-hmm. do that and kind of just do it. And Hester, who's obviously very kind of nature and farm minded and doing the right thing and planet oriented in that way. But also realizing that kind of I had gotten into food a little bit, but beer is an agricultural product. And,
it is.
And I'm in a business where we make one and sell mm-hmm. one. And that really started to change the way I thought about things around me. Grew up with my father passed, single mom. There was a lot of hot pockets and a lot of the easy, accessible food off the shelf that was a mom doing the best she can and made a ton of sense at the time. But I had never really thought much about where my food is coming from. So as I've gotten into this ecosystem to think about that question deeply, as you take that a lot further, climate change, mm-hmm. things like that, where we live in like the evolutionary place in which we stand as it relates to food, and is start to become very big questions that I can't stop thinking about. And I say all of that to say, I am very excited to talk about farms today. So what is the mission of the Maine Farmland Trust?
Yes. So Maine Farmland Trust, we're a local grassroots nonprofit organization, and we started small. It started as a group of farmers and advocates who saw farmland being gobbled up by developers and thought, gosh, you know, we want to do something about this. Fast forward 22 years, and we are one of, you know, a big player in the Maine agricultural community. Our mission is to protect farmland, support farmers, and advance the future of farming here in Maine, but also across the country. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's a big mission statement. Yeah. but the reason that I like to think about it is I'm thinking, like, why are farms important? So that's a question that I really like to ask people when yeah. I start talking about my work. So can I ask you guys, why do you think farms are important? Local farms in particular.
I'd like to think I have a little bit of an out because I've already acknowledged I have a hard time. I know it, but I have a hard time articulating the mm-hmm. the reasons. Yeah. The reasons, yeah, frankly.
I feel very strongly, without much data, that the sense of globalization and things getting big almost got ahead of itself. Mm. It almost happened too quickly.
Yeah.
And it's the thing that got me into craft beer. I had been in food already, but it kind of seemed like this microcosm of the perfect solution at the perfect time for this little thing to thrive, where it's so easy to communicate that if you go to a gas station, frankly, and grab the beer that I'm drinking right now, that supports a few jobs at the place that it's at. And then that money goes right out of your community. Yes. Couple low paying jobs, couple other things. Mm-hmm. It seems like craft beer had this kind of community aspect. It was the right place at the right time of getting smaller mm-hmm. faster. Mm-hmm. And I think as if that can play out across the entire supply chain, that you almost have these tiny little localized hubs that can interact with each other.
Yeah.
But instead of all the beef coming from Australia or the meat coming from New Zealand, if you can support the things around you, I think it handles a lot of the disease problems, income inequality problems, and a lot of these things. That's the sense that I get.
Well, that is a much more succinct answer than I normally get. Very, very good job.
Matt wins that one. Yeah.
I've been thinking about farms quite a bit.
Yeah. And, you know, that's a lot of what I think and what I would answer to is that, you know, everyone should be concerned about farming because a thriving agricultural landscape creates access. It creates access to healthy, fresh foods. Mm-hmm. It creates a sustainable food system. And that sustainable food system benefits not just the farmer, but the consumer, the local economy, the community, and you nailed it, the environment as well. Don't even get me started about the industrial food system.
Mm-hmm.
So really, it's this whole system as a whole that supports and uplifts each other, which is so important in smaller rural communities, especially.
Mm-hmm.
Awesome.
And that speaks almost exactly to what Noah's saying about Buck Farms and where we get our grain from. If generational potato farm for a long time, if it was going to continue to be generational, mm-hmm. as McCain became the bigger singular buyer of potatoes in the state and it kind of became commoditized at a price where it becomes very hard to make a living, they had yeah. to get creative and pivot to an entirely different business model to sustain, that being the grain with which we buy from them.
Yeah. And can I ask you probably most people do this too, and you're in a much more, a higher position to be able to answer this effectively now. But if you said you grew up in a small, very much a family farm, mm-hmm. It sounded like that wasn't the primary source of income for your family.
No.
But if that question was posed to you when you were 18 or something, do you have any idea what you would say before you kind of know the data that sort of surrounds you now?
Well, what was the question?
How you would answer the question you asked?
You posed that.
Yes. Okay. I have turned the tables. I think my answer would be food. I mean, I'm mm-hmm. a foodie. I love food. I want good food. Good food does not come in highly processed packages. Yep. Good food comes from good local farmers that supply it to you fresh, you know, that was picked a couple days ago or yesterday or today. So my answer would be it's all about the food.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think if fourth, that was sort of, it's kind of a combined hybrid approach. It's like what Matt said is like closer distance is better in a myriad of ways. Mm-hmm. And then you, generally smaller is better, whether that's beer, whether that's clothing, whatever consumable you're talking about. The bigger something gets, generally a lot is lost in the process. Mm-hmm. The larger that thing gets.
Absolutely. A lot of the heart is lost, which is something that you brought up too. Yep. You know, you can follow the same recipe. You can grow the same lettuce. But if you're growing it as a monocrop in a huge industrial farm and you don't really care about it, you're just trying to grow it as fast as you can and get it out the door as fast as you can, the quality of the product is not going to be the same as if you're buying it from a local farmer who really cares about the soil, cares about the type of lettuce he's growing, cares that it is in peak condition when he picks it.
You know,
all that stuff really matters.
Yeah.
Yep. Absolutely.
And I bet there's some parallels to your beer as well.
My whole thing's going to be trying to stifle me jumping in and be like, oh, it's just like that.
So AB and Bev. No, but I want to, in terms of, I moved here. I have this kind of sense now and thinking about some of these things. You said the Maine Farmland Trust was started in 22 years ago, though.
Yeah.
So about 2000.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a sense of, like I said, I hear these little things here and there, like from the Buck Boys, McCain just got so big that you couldn't make money from potatoes anymore. Do you have kind of a general sense of the problem that they were trying to solve in starting the Maine Farmland Trust and some of the other stories that people might not be aware of like what happened to farming and agriculture in Maine, which is a place that has a pretty rich history of farming and agriculture?
Yeah. I mean, a couple. You keep on skirting around one of the big ones, which is market consolidation. Mm-hmm. But before I get into that, let me back up. So when we started, it was all about protecting farmland. So land is a non-renewable resource. We can't decide we've run out of land and let's get some more.
They ain't making any more of that.
You're not going to get it. And once you pave over agrable farmland, it's essentially you're not going to get it back to be farmland. It would be so expensive, so much labor to make it be, you know, able to grow things
Certainly.
Again. So you really have to get ahead of that and make sure that all of the farmland isn't gone before we realize that this is worth protecting.
Yep.
So that's really where Maine Farmland Trust started out, was making sure that we protect farmland so that there can be farmers growing potatoes or growing whatever they want to grow in Maine forever. But one of the other challenges that you touched on was that market consolidation. And that kind of brings me back. I was trying to avoid talking about the industrial food system, but here we go.
Do it.
So we are supposed to be in this like free and open economy where there can be multiple different farmers, multiple different businesses that can all be growing and competing against each other. But that's not how our food system is in the United States anymore.
And many other systems in the United States.
Yes. So this has really been clear with the, especially dairy farmers in Maine in the past few years. They haven't been able to sell their milk at reasonable prices that they would be able to make a living off of. So these big, you know, dairy conglomerates are essentially like pushing out small farmers because they can't compete.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, not the nature of the economy that we built. And it's also just not really fair, and it doesn't bring the best product to the consumer.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can you just explain that the state mandated like cost for, or I don't know exactly how it works, but I know that there's sort of an agreed upon minimum price for milk that like you'll see advertised at like a Cumberland Farms or something. Mm-hmm. Can you explain just a little bit more about what exactly you're talking about with dairy in particular?
Yeah. I mean, I won't lie. I don't know the exact answer to that question. It's a very good one. And I'll have to research why
could have done that as well.
Those costs. But I can say that, you know, part of it is the production. So, you know, some of these production facilities that would treat the milk, you know, don't want to make the trip all the way up to Maine. And they would rather just have all of their milk produced in the Midwest or, you know, wherever they can get everything that they want, so that they don't make a stop at this farm and collect X a number of gallons and then make a stop at this farm and collect X number of gallons. you know, they are looking to, you know, simplify that process for themselves by really relying on mega farms versus relying on many small farms that, you know, maybe it takes a little bit more work to get the product from.
Yeah, totally.
And then in terms of Maine Farmland Trust, in terms of what you do personally, mm-hmm. and what your mission is within the bigger mission, what is that?
So I am the Member Communications and Engagement Manager. And my mission is right now, I mean, this summer, my goal is to get people thinking about local agriculture, why it's important, but also the challenges that farmers face right now. Mm-hmm. We're in a really critical time. The decisions that are made in the next few years will shape the future of local agriculture. And I'm talking about particularly land access, transition planning for retiring farmers, and the elephant in the room, which is, of course, the PFAS contamination.
Let's get into that. But you had touched on, in getting ready for this interview, the aging out of farmers and what's happening. Yeah. Dive into that a little bit, because stumbling across that blew me away.
So we have found that in the next decade, many of our farmers who are here in Maine right now are getting to be retirement age.
Not the youngest state in the union.
And, you know, farming isn't, you don't go into it to make oodles of money. You know, people aren't lining up at the door to get to start farming. So in the next decade, 400,000 acres of farmland is going to transition and move into new ownership. And that is a crazy statistic. Mm-hmm. And it also begs the question of who is going to buy that land.
Yeah.
Yeah. So who is? I know that is an ongoing and humongous question. Mm-hmm. Matt's mentioned, but we were talking right before you got here, just it's more almost like not colloquial.
Anecdotal.
Of just seeing and maybe that's just sort of what you're shown on. Mm-hmm. Odds are younger farmers are a lot more likely to have an Instagram page.
Yeah.
I think that there is a very real trickle down effect in terms of if that those images, that lifestyle is shown to more people, mm-hmm. it'll naturally draw more people into it. But what are just some of the challenges you face of the both attracting that next generation, instilling the values of why it's important to the people in your organization and many farmers worldwide, but also like why this is the why it's so important you should choose this and do something that frankly, like there is not an easy way to do from what I know.
Yeah. Well, a couple of things on that. So I think the first thing is thinking about access, thinking about who is going to be able to get the land and how can we make them successful as farmers. Mm-hmm. So part of that is land is very expensive, particularly in southern Maine, where the growing season is a little bit longer. So getting farmers on the land in Maine is a challenge. And part of what we're doing here at MFT is we have this farm network and this farm link, which is essentially like a little dating service for farmers.
This is the Tinder for farms.
This is the Tinder for farms we were talking about.
If it doesn't have a swipe mechanism, you guys are missing, because that swipe mechanism is so effective.
Oh, we will have to add that on to our next evolution of it. But essentially, it matches retiring farmers with aspiring farmers so that they can get a chance to meet each other, learn about the land, and help, you know, pass on some of that generational knowledge that aspiring farmers might not have, but this retiring farmer who the farm may have been in his family for generations would like to pass on to someone along with the land.
What does that actually look like? Is that a forum on a website? Is that a forum on a website? Is that a number of in-person events? Is that what is the actual mechanisms that are connecting the two sides of the equation?
Right now it's a website. Yep. So Farm Link, you can find it from our website, or if you Google Maine Farm Link, you'll find it. But then we also do, before COVID, we had a few matchmaking events. You know, I'll be honest, they weren't like super well attended. You've got to really pull farmers away from their farms. So that's why we found the online version was a little bit more effective.
Sure.
And I think when we do our big overhaul of our website, which is happening in the next year or so, that's going to be a big part of it, is integrating more of the Farm Link access information so that people who are looking to get into farming, it can be really easy to see, okay, these are the few farms available. This is the kind of infrastructure that's already in place so that they don't have to start from square one.
Yeah.
It's I didn't think about this at all beforehand, but sort of what you're talking about, Dole's Orchard in Lymington, we get, I would say probably the majority of our in the past got the majority of our fruit from them. And last year I was kind of picking up the last, we'll get it frozen. So it's kind of in low, as much of my truck and handle as I'm going up to Milo.
Riding low.
And it was the last amount that I was picking up. And he had, Earl, who had told me like they were planning on selling it and they were going to. And then, so I was kind of shook hands with him, like, have a great retirement. And then flash forward 6 months or 8 months, and he's someone I thought I would never think of again, not in a negative way, but, and calling me looking for totes and kind of in a very like different, a much more frazzled manner than I had ever experienced him in. And it's because they couldn't find anyone to buy this farm, which by all has been a flourishing U-Pick berry farm for what seems like a really long time. So to someone getting into it, it seems like the cost would be the barrier, the bigger barrier there. Yeah. It's like, this is a really established thing. Of course, it's going to cost more. So when you mentioned about being able to afford, I'm sure that's the first thing probably on the table for most of these conversations. Yep. What do you have to say on that? I won't even say, what do you guys do on that? What are your thoughts?
No, but we actually do help with that. So one of our methods of farmland protection, actually, you know, our biggest method of farmland protection is putting agricultural easements on farmland. And a really great way to facilitate the transition of a farm to a new farm owner is by putting an agricultural easement on it. Like, we're at the table with these two entities as this process is happening. So for the farmer, that's really great because they can sell the farm at the full value of the farm. But because we're at the table in purchasing the development rights, which is what an agricultural easement is, purchasing the rights so that that land can't be developed in the future for condos or a hotel or a Walmart or whatever. We are having the farmer who's retiring, who's ready to sell.
Seller on one side.
Yes. Buyer on the other side.
Buyer on the other side.
MFT, you guys in the middle.
The broker.
Yep. Exactly.
And I'm not being funny. I was, I don't mean to interrupt you at all, but as like, financial stuff is one of my like hobbies, and me and Noah talk last episode, I think I used the word capitulate like 9 times. And I've heard what an easement is, but even getting into this and kind of studying it, I don't even know if sitting in this chair right now, I have my head all the way around how an easement actually works. So just like you were before I interrupted you, but could you like explain it as if I am a 5-year-old?
Okay.
So seller one side, buyer the other, and you
MFT
in the middle.
MFT in the middle. Yeah. So at the time of purchase, an agricultural easement is put on the land. So the seller gets the full cost of the land because we're coming in and providing this kind of influx.
And that's actual capital.
That's actual capital.
That you guys have that you are actually paying.
That we are actually paying the farmer who's retiring.
Boom, he gets his whole sale price.
Wholesale price.
One side of the equation is settled and goes away.
And then for the farmer who's purchasing the land, they're purchasing it at a discounted price because we're on at the table too. And we've purchased the development rights for this farmland in the form of an agricultural easement. So they don't have to pay as much because we've already paid a portion of it. So that's essentially how that works and how we're able to help in that way.
Can I get, and then going beyond that, because it almost seems like... development rights are almost like the lack there. They're almost like the opposite. You're almost purchasing the guarantee that it won't be developed for anything else other than agriculture. The part that I have trouble like bringing the circle closed in my head is A, like where the initial capital comes from. I imagine in a trust, and we can get into all of that, which frankly, I find trusts to be better mechanisms a lot of time than like true government stuff, and we can talk all about that. But in this, in the actual transaction process, you guys come to the table with money from your trust for these development rights.
Yes.
The seller, this isn't like a loan. It's more like a grant where the difference that you make up in the influx, they never have to pay.
They never have to pay.
They get a discount.
Mm-hmm.
What do those discounts look like? Are there different ways of doing it? Are there a couple different types? Can it be like just a general sense? If a farm costs $500,000, are there some of them that are hundreds of thousands that you're saving from the farmer?
Yeah.
Stuff like that.
It all depends on the amount of land, where the land is located, the value of the land, and how much of that land is open farmland.
Okay.
Because a lot of farms have forested acres. And so it's all about the arable land that's there. And I don't have any numbers off the top of my head for you.
But it can be very large.
But it can be very large.
Can it also be very small on the other side?
Yes.
And then so I get the last piece that keeps me from closing. Your influx that comes out of the trust, how does that get paid back to MFT?
It does not get paid back to MFT. That is, we're a nonprofit.
What that thing really is you are buying, you are putting money into the table to guarantee that nobody's ever paving this thing.
No one's paving it.
Nobody's ever putting condos on this thing. This is going to be farmland until the end of time.
Until the end of time. And on top of that, we will steward that land with the farmer until the end of time. In terms of helping, they're part of our farm network. So we will send a steward out to that land every year to check in, see how the farmer's doing, see if there are any issues, walk the perimeter, like make sure that the farmland is staying as was required.
Test some soil? Test some soil, maybe?
Sometimes. Sometimes.
I'd like to ask, I think the concepts like that for most people are hard to grasp because of the infinity element of it. So my dad was, my whole life was the director of Baxter, or worked in Baxter Park for the latter half of my like teenage years, was the director, and that's how he retired. And, you know, whenever you'd get really kind of talking about the park with him, it would always come back to sort of the gift from Percival Baxter.
Our Lord and Savior.
And I don't know hopefully he won't be too mad at me. I don't know the exact, whether it was a trust, an endowment. I don't know the term for what sort of this was, but it was, I'm going to give you this massive amount of land, provided that you treat it in the ways outlined in this for the end of time, until the end of time. Not to take the negative slant at that, but I mean, just infinity's hard for people. Say something like, let's say one of these happened sort of in the early stages of where the Maine Farmers Trust was created in around 2000, is someone still every year going to that place now at exactly the same kind of determination and checking all the same boxes?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that will continue happening, you know, as long in perpetuity. And I know that is hard to grasp, but, you know, that's the way that we build relationships with these farmers. That's the way that we can help to cultivate that thriving agricultural landscape that I was talking about.
Yeah.
It's making sure that we're up to date, that we know what's happening with farmers. We know what's happening with the land. And that's, you know, like I said, it's a non-renewable resource. We have to keep it agrable. We have to keep it open. And there are some of the easements that it's okay if you're not actively farming it. You just can't be developing it.
So to finish all of that, that was when the trust was set up in 2000, was that with a massive donation of some kind that starts the trust with one huge sum of money? That my understanding of a trust, when Percival does this, and a couple of
first name
the other ones, he was a great guy, but there's a, like the Alphon is it's the arena that the UMaine University plays their games on, named after him, and he donated this massive amount of money that has like a college tuition fund to all of these people. And the way I understand trusts is that they are amount of money that's so big at the time that if managed responsibly and just the interest is collected and you do the right things with that money, you can get to a theoretical perpetuity or infinity. Is that how the Maine Farmland Trust started?
I mean, yes and no. We certainly did have, you know, a big influx of money at the beginning, But it's an every year thing. We have a development department. We are fundraising. That's a huge part of what we have to do, is we have to raise the funds. And part of that is because the costs associated with buying farmland, the costs associated with, you know, the business planning that we do for farmers, all of that costs more now than it did 20 years ago.
100%. So there's active fundraising is a huge part of what happens. Just like
I also think what you're is an endowment. And I don't know where the where that line where it changes. Yeah, like what
you're absolutely right. I think I'm blurring a couple lines.
I know that was for Baxter Park.
I think you set up a trust. You give an endowment and set up a trust on that endowment, and that's how you can do some of these things. You're absolutely right.
Is that true?
You can back that up?
Okay, sure. Let's trust that it's true.
I'm quite confident. Okay, and correct in what you said. But just to. Want to get to the PFAS, absolutely. But the like we had just done the whole Matthew Parks episode about fundraising and chair for these incredible things. What are some of the mechanisms and things that you guys are using and coming up with to raise money for this good cause?
Yeah, well, we're a member-powered organization. Mm-hmm. So like I said, we started grassroots, and that's how we want it to continue. We want people in the community to be invested, whether that's at a $5 level, $10 level, sure, $10,000 level. Like, that's all great. We want it to be everyone who's in this community is invested in this work. That's why we're member-powered. So a lot of what we're doing is we're reaching out to people on a, you know, first name basis. We're calling the people that we know. We're trying to get people to invest in this work. And that's how we've been successful so far, is just having people in Maine and having people just in the country in general see the value of farming and local farming and decide that it's a worthy investment personally for themselves.
100%.
Is there a... let's use the example of Doles. So let's say they're a member of is there a minimum dues?
No.
Wow. That's that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
That's and probably a lot of times in more stressful times at work, it is very much not cool. If I had to take a guess, but from the intention side and the inclusivity side of that, because as we said, you know, farming is about as far from a quick buck as you could find for 100%. A profession.
Definitely.
So it seems to kind of respect that.
And I want to be like upfront that a lot of our members, yes, we have members who are farmers, but a lot of the members who are donating aren't farmers. Yeah. They're the consumers. They're the people who love the farms that are in their neighborhood and want to do something more than just buying produce, because we are working on the systematic changes that 100%. Will be able to make these farms sustainable long term. Yes.
Keep the planet around long enough to live on it and do some stuff.
You know, kind of important.
Yeah, good work. Just real quick, I was blown away by even just a few people reaching out and saying that they got involved in the Barbara Bush like givers program and signed up. It's like a subscription sort of thing after the episode. If people do want to get involved and want to donate or become members, where do they go?
Please, mainfarmlandtrust.org. Donate, get involved. It's all right there. At any level, we just want people to be aware of what we're doing, and we want people to invest in their local farmers. And that's not only at the farm stand, but also through us, so that we can make the big changes that we want to. And we can go to these legislative sessions and fight for farmers' rights, which is a big part of what we're doing as well.
Killer. And if you click on the video that has all the little like it won a Sundance icon little thing, it's like a 3-minute video. I'll give you goosebumps. Take your breath away.
It's good. It's incredible. Good stuff. Yeah.
Now, my friend.
You're really setting PFAS stuff big.
You get your elephant.
Something you had said earlier, addressed it as the elephant in the room. It was not an elephant I was aware of at all, I think, which speaks very much to where I'm someone wanting to learn, but not in any place of authority.
My best friend's a civil engineer. That's the only reason I know. I know what they are.
So educate me and presumably a good amount of other people in
about the
in why
chemicals.
This is such a problem.
Yeah. Okay. Full disclosure, I'm not a scientist or a PFAS expert. But MFT has been on the front lines of PFAS discovery in Maine, so I will share with you guys what I've learned.
Yep.
PFAS stands for per- and polyfluoroalkyline substances. That describes about 4,700 chemicals that are all man-made, and they're all containing linked carbon and fluorine. So that's a little general information. But to set the story, let's go all the way back to the 1930s, which is when these chemicals were, you know, invented. And they were really revolutionary at the time because they repel oil, water, and grease. So paper mills and firefighter foam were big producers of PFAS. But also, and even more importantly, they were used in many common household items. Think about like microwave popcorn bags and takeout containers, waterproof clothing, ski wax, Teflon, non-stick cooking pans. Exactly. So humans have been ingesting these chemicals for decades through the foods that we eat, but also through some contaminated drinking water.
Mm-hmm.
And think about how widespread these products are. They're everywhere. I can't think of any household in America that doesn't have either a nonstick pan or takeout containers in the fridge. So as a result, most Americans in the U.S. and so many people across the country, across the world, have varying levels of PFAS. And our and our human waste is shown to contain especially high levels. So municipal sewage is leaching chemicals into our soil and drinking water. And the lands where firefighter foam has been used has been particularly contaminated. So think about like military bases and airports. But I'm at Maine Farmland Trust. So taking the farming angle here, human waste, aka sludge, has been sold to farmers as a safe and natural fertilizer for years.
Yeah.
So these farmers have been, at no fault of their own, spreading sludge filled with these toxic chemicals all over their farmland.
Yeah.
Which then the vegetables that they're growing on that farmland are then absorbing the chemicals and containing toxic levels. The livestock that's on that land that is eating the grass or the hay are also being contaminated. So as you can gather, it's like a really systemic issue.
And for- I knew of sludge. I didn't know, that was all kind of in this place. And I guess I would just ask or just sort of pose the point that probably presumably is what you fight against the most in the in this type of conversation is, well, if everyone, how bad can it be if everyone already has it in them and we're still here? Nobody's, there's not a PFAS death outbreak or whatever. How do you answer that sort of counterpoint?
Yeah.
Well, because it is. I mean, it's linked to a lot of really serious health effects, such as elevated cholesterol, thyroid disease, damage to the liver and kidneys, elevated risk for certain cancers, and decreased immunity for particularly in children. The additional element of this that's so concerning is that they are forever chemicals. They don't break down naturally. So the way I like to describe this to people is think about taking a gallon full of glitter and throwing it into a kiddie pool full of sand and stirring it around.
Yeah.
That sand.
You'll never see it, but it's always there.
Because to be frank, I was going to ask the exact same question of like, if it's not affecting life expectancy or if it's not affecting these tangible things that you can measure right now, you can kind of do you take it with a grain of salt or do you don't? The forever thing is where it really twists the knob on that. If this accrues over time, and then you look at there was a DuPont plant that was putting it on, was making it to put on the nonstick cookware, and they had a little break or were just doing things irresponsibly in the way they were disposing of it, and right around that plant cows were dying. It was more livestock than anything else, but humans were getting cancer. When you get it in a certain concentration, it's really, really bad. It's really bad. Forever, so the concentrations are only ever going to rise. I think that I find that part worrisome and interesting. But what also seems to be happening is that the government is just kind of getting aware of this. So they're just beginning to try to tackle it. But the way they're tackling it tends to be hurting the people that are trying to do regenerative farming and buying. So you buy land. You've done this stuff. You're a small guy or girl who can't really fight the big battles. You're not Monsanto, these huge farms. You're a small one. You buy this land. You farm on it for a bit. But if I understand correctly, if your measurements are at a certain place or they're starting to do this, they can just shut down
Absolutely.
And not allow you to farm.
Absolutely.
So MFT does the work to pair you with Earl, get the farm sold, yada, 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 but then runs measurements and comes in. And if you've got PFAS, you're shut down. And again, government trying to do the right thing. That seems to be things that are just starting to pop up right now.
Absolutely.
That I find incredibly interesting. And how are you guys, mm-hmm. what are you guys doing on that front?
Yeah. A couple things there. So, you know, what you touched on was that it's just starting to be known and the federal mm-hmm. government is just starting to take steps on it. Maine is at the forefront of this issue, but not because our land is contaminated any more than other lands across the country, but because, you know, Mainers certainly aren't eating any more food out of takeout containers than other people.
Yeah.
But because we're one of the only states that is being proactive in addressing this. So by that standard, we're really far ahead of the game. And the Environmental Working Group is a really great resource for anyone who's interested in learning more about and seeing some statistics. On my way in, I just looked it up and they're saying that 5% of all cropland in the United States, which is, you know, 20 million acres, is contaminated.
Yeah.
So just because other states aren't testing for it doesn't mean it's not there.
Mm-hmm.
So getting back to our action, I don't want to be all doom and gloom about this. Like we're taking action. And being proactive about it. And of course, MFT is working on this issue, but also I have to say, so are a lot of other really great organizations in Maine, some nonprofits, of course, the Maine legislature and the Department of Agriculture. But here at MFT, the number one thing that we're doing is our PFAS Emergency Fund. And this happened as a result of conversations with farmers asking them, what do you need? And that fund is really trying to get to what you were mentioning before of farmers have no control over this, and then their livelihoods are completely taken away.
Because the government does and can shut them down and
yes.
say you're not allowed to grow yes. here, correct?
And farmers will say it themselves. You know,
I don't want to be.
I don't want to be selling yeah. products that are going to be toxic to my consumers. I don't want to be eating the products myself. You know, most farmers are consuming their own products or drinking their own well water. If it's toxic, like they,
yeah.
you know, that's a big problem. So the fund that we've set up, it has like five major prongs. Prong number one is providing income replacement to farmers. So that's that kind of stopgap of if you are contaminated and you can't sell your products anymore, we will send you a check
yeah.
in the mail to cover your costs
yeah.
so that you can continue doing what you need to do. You can support your family. You can keep on your workers.
Wow.
Which, you know, it's been really lucky that a lot of people have come together and put money in this fund.
Yeah.
But we've been really able to do that. And of course, you know, the state of Maine is stepping in as well and doing a lot of this also. But the way that the government works, like it's harder. It takes a longer to get that assistance from the state. So the state will refer farms to us and we'll send them a check that week. Yeah. So that was prong number one.
Yeah.
Prong number two is providing testing and funding support for farmers. So comprehensive PFAS testing is so expensive.
Yeah.
It's like thousands of dollars per farm, and you have to bring a specialist on to do it. So that's something that we'll take care of for the farmers. You know, we'll bring in the specialists, we'll provide the funding for them so that they can know if their farm is contaminated or not. Can
yeah.
they keep selling their products or not? Yeah. Okay, I'm going to keep going.
Give me the whole pitchfork.
We're providing wellness funds. So that's mostly actually through one of our partner organizations, MOFCA, but we're providing a stipend to farmers and to workers who are on the farms if they need wellness support, if they are stressed out and need to go seek therapy about this, if they can't drink their own water on their farm and need to bring in bottled water, if their family needs to go to the doctor a little bit more because of contamination, that's something that we're helping out with. Number four is infrastructure grants to farmers if they need to change their practices as a result of PFAS contamination.
Mm-hmm.
So an example of this is, again, going back to the water. You know, we had a farmer recently who had contaminated drinking water, and we provided them a grant so that they could build a water filtration system.
Yeah.
Simple as that.
Totally.
And then the final is just helping, you know, understand the system and being there for farmers to call us if they have questions and they don't know how to navigate the system of applying for the right things within the government so that they can get the grants that they need, so that they can get the funding that they need. We kind of step in and help guide them through this process.
Amazing.
Incredible.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. that's amazing.
It's a lot.
That's
yeah.
That's truly amazing.
It's asbestos again.
One thing that I'm very curious about, because I it's pretty easy for me to put myself in the shoes of a younger, sort of a new generation that is attracted by sort of the back to the landness, the romanticism, mm-hmm. like the mm-hmm. just that a hard day's work lifestyle that yeah. that farming, at least on paper, provides. Mm-hmm. But I know just things like people, I think nowadays have this odd, like the gap between what you think you know and what you actually know, I think has widened in many cases from just yeah. thinking you know by knowing the tiniest fragment about it. It's very easy to think like I know about it. And it's frankly not true in almost all cases. And with farming, which is such a complex, I mean, you're literally managing an ecosystem.
100%.
What are whether it's horror stories, whether it's just the same problem over and over, what do maybe people that got in a little over their heads with the mm-hmm. idea of wanting to pursue this lifestyle, what do you see as the main challenges for sort of just people very green at what they're trying to do?
Yeah. I mean, it's dependent on the person. Yeah. A lot of it is like there's only so much you can control in farming. You can't control the weather. Mm-mm. You can't control, you know, you can do the best that you can to make your crops grow, but sometimes it's a hot summer or sometimes your potatoes will grow mold. And I think having that backup plan is something that a lot of young farmers don't know yet and also don't have, you know, that network of supporters, of that network of people who have more knowledge that they can rely on.
Yeah.
So that's part of our farm network is trying to make sure that there is that community of farmers so that if you have a question, there's someone who has an answer. Like uh-huh. you're not going to be the only farmer who's dealt with this issue, but you have to find them and know the right questions to ask.
And I feel like even that, like just thinking about myself, whether it's another place we get a ton from is Berry Fruit Farm in Livermore.
Mm-hmm.
And generally speaking, farmers want to call you. Mm-hmm. That is the method of preferred communication. It is not, I'm always just feel like painfully awkward in most places, certainly on the phone. and yeah, it's just not how most people my age, it's their first thing to do. So I kind of lost my train of thought even in what I was railing against phone conversations. I got it back. But sort of the forced interaction almost. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's even that people want to avoid the interaction mostly, but it's like, it's just not part of your repertoire to be like, yeah. I'm just going to go to this farm and like talk to them and ask them about all the stuff.
Yeah.
Is that sort of where you see sort of the in-between being the most helpful in those situations? Like, no, we'll definitely help you get FaceTime with this person who's also very motivated for you to learn because
yes.
in a perfect world, you're buying this place.
Absolutely. And I would also say that's a very generational thing for us is like, I hate getting on the telephone.
Yeah.
But if you get an older farmer on the phone, he will talk your ear
text.
Off.
Yeah.
They're not going to text. They're not going to send you an email, but they certainly will talk to you.
Yeah.
So I think that has been, you know, a bridge that we can also help with. And I think the other, you know, many other things, but another one is just finding the right markets and finding people who are willing to pay a little bit extra to buy your products. Because let's be honest, it's cheaper to go to the Target, you know, down the street and buy lettuce from who knows where or potatoes from who knows where. And it's hard, you know, you have to convince people almost that it's worth buying your products
yes.
over spending a little bit less to buy industrialized products.
And that's a narrative that's really interesting to me because it's something yeah. we deal with going back to the parallels thing.
But it also seems like it's changing a little bit to take the flip side of some of the horror story stuff or the things that are hard. Again, it's anecdotal, but you get the with documentaries on Netflix and mm-hmm. just like, you know, like seeing these images on Instagram and the romanticism that frankly it can just kind of be the like what's out there in the ether, but also I choose to believe is kind of this natural mean reversion of when the world gets very technological very quickly. Like we lived on land for about 100,000 something, and in about 800 we got real far away from that real fast. There almost seems to be a little bit of mean reversion that's happening right now in terms of that general macro trend. Do you feel, I guess, like you're screaming into the abyss a little bit less than it might have felt like 3 years ago? Are you seeing trends that are making you hopeful?
Absolutely.
Talk about the kind of the macro stuff of what's happening with farms in Maine.
I think a lot of young people are more interested in in farming, like you said, that either the romanticized version or just, you know, on a personal level, I am sick of the hustle grind culture. And I think a lot of other people are, particularly of our age, who are like brought up to be like in this
grind your face off.
Exactly. Yes. In this grind your face off mindset. And, you know, that's
but
why.
But you should. I just want to be clear. You should, though. But go on.
We all should. Like, you know, I say that and I work like 57
Do
hours
it on
week.
A farm.
But I think that so many people are sick of city life and want to feel connected to something more. Part of that is being connected to community and part of that is being connected to the land. And so I'm, you know, personally, I mean, this is my dream. I want to get out on the land. And I think that there are so many other people who want that as well. And that's why I'm really hopeful for the future of farming, not just in Maine, but across the country and the future of like revitalized rural communities, which is also really important to me.
That's what we're doing in Milo.
Yeah.
And that's what made me so excited about it when it started, was that like these boys could have gone to Boston. They could have gone to New York. You could have gone to anywhere with a population more than 1,500 and made more money than you're making here. Like
Let's pick the lowest, oldest, lowest population county that's also
What's
the
poorest. What's the lowest median income around this place? but it told me about who they are and what their drivers are. And when you're seeing that, because I actually saw or found data somewhere that that Maine has, for one of the oldest states in the union. I don't know why I keep saying the union, like we're in the middle of the Civil War. One of the oldest, it's coming.
Yeah.
One of the oldest states in the country. We have over the last, I forget if it was 12 months, 18 months, 2 years, some of the youngest farm ownership starting to happen. I believe I saw that in cold hard data. If the way of farming of the past is some of what's led to this, right? Because I've also read stories of literally selling your products at a loss because you're already just, you're entrenched in all the equipment. This is your lifestyle. So even though these onions aren't going to make me money, I grew the damn things. I'm not going to not sell them.
No.
And kind of this like bittering out of making money year over year, going into debt or whatever happens. What is changing in the actual model of farming and the economics of farming to allow younger people or this newer generation that's going to replace the old to do it in a way that is, that makes them money? Because frankly, no matter how good, great it feels is that it's going to save the planet someday, making a living and making money is still the greatest incentivizer of human beings.
I mean, right. You can't get into this and expect to eventually become destitute from it. Like no one's gonna.
But you're gonna feel great. Back
you'll
on
feel
the
great.
Land.
You'll do good. But I think, you know, it's that our generation, people are innovative. We're ready to bring our innovation to our own small businesses. So small farmers who are younger and who are getting on the land are being innovative with what they're doing. You know, a couple examples that come to the top of my mind is more community-based farming. So there are some farms that are collaborative farms where a couple of people, a family will come in or a group of families will come in and buy a farm together, work the farm together, and that way they're invested together. They have workers who are all invested together that are sharing in the success and the hardships of being on a farm.
Yeah.
And I think that that model has worked, you know, for generations, but is really just starting to have a resurgence of people who are willing to, you know, it's not me and my land, it's ours, and having that kind of collaborative nature, which has been really successful so far for the farms that we've seen.
Because it just lessens those input costs and some of those things.
And it lessens the burden.
Do those people, I'm sorry to interrupt, but it's innovative. It's incredible. Are those people collaborating on a farm only? Or does that allow them to maintain another income and then do the farm as well? Is that what makes it work?
It could be a mixture of both, but okay. I think that it's having more than one person to shoulder the responsibility and the cost.
Yeah.
And having the people who are working the farm all be invested in it versus just like hiring workers. You know, people who are, it's their heart and soul. And it's also, here's my brother's heart and soul and well, and here's our other friend who's joining us with it, you know, on this farm. So that's one of the innovative things that makes me really excited. Another thing is thinking about dual use land, which is really exciting. And it kind of actually brings me a little bit back to PFAS of like remediation and like how we can get rid of these chemicals. But again, it's the innovation of young farmers. So a project that's still in its infancy, but something that I'm really excited about is the combination of dual use solar with lands that are contaminated with PFAS. So the idea here is that solar, green energy is really important, particularly in Maine. But where
and
is
the... you see them going up at a rapid
exactly.
pace
right
everywhere.
Up above us.
Yeah, but where's the best place for those to be? In open, sunny places.
Yeah.
What is also great for that area? Farming. Mm-hmm. So we want to be really cognizant about that. But for particularly farms that are contaminated with PFAS, having solar panels on the land provides them with the income that they need to continue having a business. And then during that period of time, they can put, put plants on the land that will absorb the PFAS chemicals, dispose of them because they can't be eaten.
Wow. Yeah,
but then they are creating clean energy, cleaning the soil. And it's really a win-win, an innovative win-win for farmers, which is...
Mr. Clean shows
I don't
up
mean
that
to
one.
Be like... Boom, get like excited hearing say that, but then go right back to like it is a forever chemical. Mm-hmm. The crop will remove it from the land. Then how do you dispose of the crop that has the chemical? Where does that go in after that?
It goes to a landfill that doesn't have water source that can be leached into.
Oh, hell yeah.
So it goes to
it just
a,
goes
know,
forever to a place where
forever
it can leak
to a
around
place where
less.
They can
just
all
like
be
the hands
toxic
that had
together.
It on. Yeah, right.
Hell yeah.
What are some of the better, I'm sure there's certain crops, certain plants that are better at that absorption or, mm-hmm. Or if not even, I'm just curious about sort of the timeline on where you start to see, actionably lower levels.
Well, like I said, this is in its infancy.
Yeah,
this is like an idea that like we're starting on, you know, I can tell you that leafy greens in particular are better at absorbing, leafy greens, yes, are better at absorbing the chemicals, worse to eat, but like corn absorbs less.
Gotcha.
So, you know, we do know that, but this is all new. This is really, you know, Maine and the CDC are really doing a ton of research into this, but we need more innovative young farmers who are like ready to tackle battles or innovative young chemists who are ready to tackle this battle to get involved and try to figure out ways that we can help.
Mm. Back to the innovative way to make these farms work in a new economy. How do you guys think about agrotourism? Because from my lens, that seems, I'm biased and I got a tendency of being biased about things that excite me. But like we've had like Tilted Barn on here. It's a brewery. Phenomenal, right on their land. Zach at Fox Farm,
love
Oyster
Fox
River
Farm.
Wine Growers.
Yes.
And to me, as a service person who's very interested in these things, like I start to think seriously that my end game is something like this, where I bring somebody into my life. I have one use of the place that is a business. And then the second use of that place is come pay, not in a cheesy way, but come pay to take part in the business or witness it or experience it or whatever it is. That seems to be a model that seems to be growing in Maine.
Absolutely.
Things jump out at me like Topsoil Farm.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you're familiar with them, but I can't go on Instagram anymore without seeing people posting about them and just talk. Yeah, agrotourism seems to be having a resurgence here in Maine. Is that the case?
It absolutely is. And it is a huge way that farmers can bring in like a dual stream of income.
Exactly.
So this is something that really excites me too. So I'm glad you brought it up. There are a couple of farms that come to my mind that are doing this really well. Frith Farm, which is in the Scarborough area, they have, you know, Friday and Saturday night barnyard hootenannies
where they have
live music and farmyard dinners and invite people to come in. They do tours. 10-acre farm, which is a little bit, you know, north of Kittery, does goat hikes, where you can come and hike with a herd of goats.
I love goats.
I love goats. At a level
you wouldn't understand.
I would understand.
I think my dog is part, anyways.
So I totally see that as a great thing for farmers to do if they have the means and if they have the inclination. Like, it takes almost a different personality to be, you know, really good at farming and also really good at agrotourism and like tour guiding. So totally.
It's an entirely different skill set from what tend to be people of different brains.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right. But I think it's really exciting. And to that, if any listeners want to get out on farms, there is a free summer farms activity map on our website where I have some itineraries of different adventures that you can do on farms, like that goat hiking, like the hootenannies, like the Toddy Pond Farm, which is up in the Belfast area, is also doing these like really gorgeous gourmet farm to table dinners. So make sure to check that out
online.
Yeah.
You seem to be skirting Topsail Farm. They must not be a member. You know what I'm saying?
Well, that'll be gone. So, it also seems to call back to something you mentioned before we started recording about.
Yes.
I can't remember the exact term. It was like a farm day. Pretty much.
Yeah.
Talk about that.
Yes. So Open Farm Day happens every year in Maine. It's July 24th. Many farms across the state open up their doors and invite people to come in to tour the farms. They have samples. It's all free. It's all wonderful. Like, I highly recommend you check it out. And actually, Governor Mills this year proclaimed July 17th to 23rd as Explore Maine Agricultural Week in honor of Maine's farmers, the variety of products grown and produced in our state, and the alliances that we keep that keep our food and agricultural industry thriving, which then culminates with this July 24th Open Farms Day. So if you're looking for an excuse to get out on a farm, this is exactly that excuse.
Cool.
That's incredible.
Wow. Yeah.
And is that what other bodies are involved? Is that put on by you guys? Is that a few bodies in conjunction?
That's farmers.
That's the kind of something that they commandeered themselves. And
yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Seeing the organization.
Thinking about that agrotourism, thinking about like opening your doors, you know, there's this quote of you protect what you love.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have that opportunity to get on a farm and see it in person and meet the farmer and be like, oh my gosh, I buy your products all the time. And now I know you. Now I've seen the cows, that
100%.
Milk, you know, it really makes it full circle.
100%.
And there's so many opportunities. You know, Maine isn't just dairy farms or produce farms. We have fiber farms. We have oyster farms. We have, you know, vineyards. We have breweries. So there really is the whole gambit of what you can find here in Maine.
Dewey, the big thing looking into all this stuff in terms of what we produce and broccoli. We make a bunch of broccoli in Maine. I did not know that. I don't know why I didn't think so, but
I didn't know
broccoli than I realized.
We have some.
That's all I got.
That's all I know. Yeah. A lot of garlic, apparently, yeah. Right
that
now.
That brings me back to the broccoli gate I was hearing on one of your other podcast episodes recently of people not being able to post pictures of broccoli.
I remember broccoli gate.
Maybe that's why I haven't been seeing it on Instagram recently.
That's why nobody knows we grow
it. No one knows.
You can't put it out there.
That is actually sort of just an interesting random question. With the cannabis industry booming, is there the crossover, since it's not an I don't know, like where's your relationship to that?
We do have a few farms that are doing hemp, so they mostly do CBD products, but we definitely have, you know, Love Grown LLC is one of them. They're really fantastic, and you know, it's another product, it's another agricultural crop, so Yeah, all for it.
So much of it seems to happen indoors.
That's in kind of why I asked. Industrial that's setting. Like, well, if you're doing it inside, then you're kind of off the table. I
mean, that land's got cement on it, and it can never. Yeah.
You're not preserving much in it if it's a raised bed.
You're not preserving much if it's in a,
Once cement's there, you're out of, off the table.
Got it.
Can I do, go ahead. Can I do, I want to do one more as we get into wrapping up. I don't know your kind of excitements or stuff around it, but one of the, touched on a little bit at the beginning, one of the huge realizations for me over the last few years was the role at which soil plays in climate change and in sequestering carbon. Mm-hmm. And kind of, it took a while to kind of understand what has happened, that not only does the thing that you said, dude, don't get me started, the food industry in America, and really globally, a lot of this happened with globalization, but the way it goes takes so much energy that it emits so much CO2.
Yeah.
But then what it does as you till the land, my understanding, that's tilling the land just starts a process to desertification where it won't be able to sequester anymore or grow anything. And then I think I never had an understanding that, like, the Monsanto stuff, it's not terrible in the fact that it like poisons everything around it, and there's even debate whether the cancer stuff was real, but what it does is cover up the bad practices that you're doing to the land for long enough to make it fertile. You know what I'm saying? That if you didn't have that to do that, you wouldn't be able to treat the land that way because it would be infertile and wouldn't grow for you immediately. It stretches that 10 years or whatever, and we just go around wrecking the growable land that we have in this country in a system that puts out a ton of CO2 and ruins the stuff that can, that this planet has developed over 4 billion years to take that all back into the ground and sequester it.
Totally.
How much of the global warming, climate change part of the equation is a mission for you personally and then is a mission for the Maine Farmland Trust?
Huge on both counts.
Word.
Huge on both counts. Soil health is, you know, is one of the major ways that we can tangibly ourselves battle climate change. And farmers are at the forefront of this as our like land stewards. In fact, it's so funny you bring this up because yesterday I was at an event on Stone Cipher Farm and Ian Jarelmack, the farmer there, was teaching us about how to have no-till farming.
Exactly.
And, you know, it was incredible. And he has had a really successful transition to having no-till on his farm. And if you guys are interested in learning more, you know, look on his website, reach out. I can send you some pamphlets. But it's really fantastic. And he has seen not only it decrease his costs, but increase his produce and increase the amount of things that he's growing and his ability to, like, continually, you know, have things growing and less effort put in. And so it's a really fantastic way of farming and people should get on board.
Mm. Cool.
And not to be stupid, but I almost get the sense of, like, if we want these human creature comforts and we want to wear the shoes and do the stuff and da-da-da, we can, if we just stop tilling the ground, we could do a lot more of that without the double on top of it. And you could probably convince a lot more Republicans to get behind that and we could actually make some change around it.
Wait, we still get Nikes?
You know what I'm saying? You still get that we just can't till the ground.
Yeah.
And we can get this place to be a better place.
Maybe a little more complicated than that, but
it's helpful. It's a great place
good place to start.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. Isabel, thank you so much for taking the time to sit down with us. Is there anything, parting words before we do a little, the way we end all? Have you said you've listened to a couple of these?
I have, yes.
Do you know about the three bay at the end
I'm
of it?
I'm ready.
We're not, so this will be good. But is there any parting words you want to leave?
Yeah.
Any messages from the MFT? Any other things that people can go look for you?
Totally. So if you are fired up by what I was talking about, particularly with PFAS, we're going to be looking for some volunteers during the next federal legislative session. So we've been really successful in creating systems to protect farmers and support farmers dealing with PFAS here in Maine, but there are farmers across the country. And it's really vital that we have a federal safety net for farmers as we start exploring and finding more PFAS contamination across the country. Mm-hmm. So if that is something that has fired you up and gotten you interested, we are looking for volunteers. Shoot me an email. We're going to be starting doing some training this fall and really activating folks during the federal legislative session this winter. Besides that, get out, enjoy farms, get some good blueberries, make some scones, you know, all's good. And if you want to become a member, join up.
Ooh, absolutely. With the Barbara Bush episode, hopefully the same trend will follow, and you'll see
the gang will come out. You'll have some gang members in the NFT.
Yeah.
Love it.
Well, thank you so much. This was, I learned as much as I can learn in an hour, I think. I think if I'm being honest with myself.
Yeah.
Just to kind of throw it light to get out of here. You'd mentioned, like my wife, you also have the shark tracking app on your phone.
Okay.
I'm going to give you three species of shark.
Okay.
And as always, pretty esoteric and weird. Mm-hmm. And however you want, match these up with either a farm partner, or whether it's a farm, just a membership partner, with the Maine Farmland Trust.
I'm on. How,
okay.
This will be the great white. You know what I'm saying?
Let's go. Probably the most cartoonized shark, the hammerhead.
Okay.
Let's go with Mako. Do you know much about the Mako?
I do. Very fast.
Okay, perfect.
They're saucy.
Oh, yeah.
And then obviously the big one, the great white dog.
Yes.
Well, I'll cross off the easy one. Of course, Bissell's going to be the great white. You know, I'm here. You teed me up.
Keep moving, we just had
sink. For the hammerhead, I'm going to go with the Wolf's Neck Center because, you know, they're great. They're fun. They're kind of kid friendly. I'm not saying that like maybe kids should go swimming with hammerhead sharks, but they kind of have that like cute look. So I'm going to go with the Wolf's Neck Center for the hammerhead and the Mako shark. Let's see who's going to be my Mako shark. I think the Mako shark is going to be. I am going to say that the Mako shark is Bumbleroot Farm.
Bumbleroot Farm,
a farm that I've kind of got to know a little bit yesterday. They're small, they're getting bigger, they're saucy and fun, and you know, young farmers there. So
cool. Well, again, Isabel, thank you so much for taking the time to do this. Couldn't have learned more in the amount of time we had, and just really excited in a new sort of in new way of invigoration of just sort of where our relationship can go.
Yeah.
Perfect. Thank you guys so much for this opportunity. It's been great to chat with you. Great to talk about my favorite topics, which are food, farming, and MFT.
And even sharks at the end.
And
sharks at the end.
Cool. Well, thank you so much. I'm sure it won't be the last time we get to chat a little bit.
Absolutely. Tell Hester I say hi.
Will do. She'll be very excited about the sharks. Bye. I'm in the mood to be slow and careful.